Well, first, I just want to say thank you so much for inviting for Amy and Patrick for all your work. I know this is, we've done a lot of work with this as well. I just wanted to say thank you for the opportunity to address you and really the opportunity to do research in the digital archives that you guys are creating. I would say that it has been kind of mind-blowing, truthfully. I'm mainly a 20th century historian, and so for me, the opportunity to think about these records and think about this time period has just been incredible. And I feel that I've learned a lot. Actually, there's a lot that I don't know. And in the end of at least whatever comments I have, I think I'll have a few questions that I was left with as I did this research. I think for me, though, the one thing that I was most interested in and most drawn to was thinking about how I can find Black people and Black people's lives and understand their lives in this time period. Really, it's the thing I'm always interested in, culturally, politically, economically. And so for me, it was just an incredible experience. And actually, it's an experience that I think is extended even into this moment. I'm happy to have my brother here. We are, I guess, Black Kentuckians. And so to stand here, I think, in this chamber where, much like the Tipling laws that I'll describe, there were laws that were designed, debated, enacted, really to better hold our ancestors captive. It's been kind of an interesting experience, and so I don't know if they envisioned this day, but I think my ancestors do. I want to be certain that I give them praise and honor as well. The effort, I think, to find Black people in these records is what brought me to Tipling. And maybe you're familiar with Tipling, perhaps you're not. I was not before I came to these records, but essentially Tipling is laws that were about excessive drinking, drinking without license, drinking without permits. And for African Americans, these laws had been connected to the attempt to better control Black people, to keep slaves from becoming free. The way in which they were described, at least in this time period, was to prevent insurrection, that is, to prevent people from gaining their freedom. And so the laws essentially and ultimately would say that whether enslaved or free Black people, you could not possess alcohol, you could not buy it, you could not sell it, it could not be given to you, you could not enter any place where it was consumed, essentially. That is, coffee houses, taverns, bars, all of those places were off limits to Black people. And this effort was, on one hand, about controlling Black people, controlling where they could go, where they could not go, controlling even what they could put in their own bodies, controlling access to money and markets. But it was also about, explicitly in the laws, that is, about the authority of owners, the authority of masters, the authority of whites to control and regulate Black people's behavior. And during the time period of these governors, the time period of the Civil War, there had already been a number of Tipling laws. In fact, for me as a 20th century historian, I felt a little nervous not knowing about these laws, so I tried to do a little bit of research about them. And one of the things I found is that they had seemed to have come over into Kentucky at its very inception when it was a part of Virginia. And from that time forward, they had made a series of amendments to these laws. And the most recent in this time period had actually been in 1861, and then I think again in 1862, explicitly in the time period of the Civil War to prevent insurrection, to keep Black people enslaved at a time where slavery was dying all around them. So to me, that was a curious thing. To be clear, Tipling is not just about Black people. There are all kinds of records that I found that deal with tippling, many whites, in fact, many whites, even in the records that I looked at, were really the primary writers. It seems that black people were just kind of caught in those records. And so for me, it gave me a great chance to really kind of think about what this question was all about. And to be clear, I had no answers about this. I think I really went into it, as I said, looking for black people and looking under search terms that I hoped would bring black people to the fore. So I looked for Negroes, I looked for free blacks, I looked for mulattoes, I looked for slaves, I even looked for niggers. That came up too, occasionally. So all those records brought a variety of different things about black people and their lives in this time period, which I think many of you are already writing about and thinking about, so hopefully there will be a good chance for us to discuss those connections. But I think for me, these records about tippling just stood out, maybe because there were so many of them. Maybe they vary regionally. I'm not really quite sure what it is, or maybe it was really just about alcohol. And ultimately, that's what I came to recognize, that thinking about tippling was thinking about alcohol, and it was thinking about emancipation. The two seem to go hand in hand, in part because for black people to get their hands on alcohol, they had to do all the things that the slave codes were trying to keep them from doing. They gathered illegally, unlawful assembly, they would have called it. They traded and hired their own time sometimes. They had money, which they weren't supposed to have. In fact, there was one interesting case where a slave was found with a gallon of brandy, $16, his change for using a $20 counterfeit bill that was used to purchase the liquor. So all these things help me recognize that for black people to get liquor, they were outdoing all the things that they were not supposed to do. They were out at night, they had money, they were engaged in markets. And this was clearly not only about enslaved black people, but free black people as well. I think one of the things that the records really helped me see in ways that I think were reflected nationally, obviously, in black codes and those sorts of things that existed in the North, but the way in which free blacks, of course, were not really free, that these laws really did try to limit not only their mobility and access to markets, but even really the idea of equality. Right? That if they were free and they were black, they were not quite as free as whites. They could not engage in these markets, but it also helped me see the connections between free black communities and enslaved communities. Sometimes they were the same family. Sometimes they were drinking side by side. Sometimes they were working with one another. Tippling raised a lot of questions, I found. It raised questions about money. It raised questions about markets. Even sometimes about wages. There were cases where African Americans were paid to do work, enslaved African Americans were paid to do work, but paid in liquor. They were given beer to cut grass or some whiskey to clean out a barn. Sometimes they were the ones selling liquor. And that raised questions about how they got property and how they made money and all those kinds of things. So tippling, I think for me, just raised a whole host of questions and just seemed an incredible opportunity to think about black people and their lives in the state of Kentucky. But it was also a chance really to think about the people who were writing petitions as well. Overwhelmingly, the petitions that were written to the Civil War governors were not written by black people. There are a few that were written by black people, some like a woman, Ann Carson, who wrote from Louisville, Kentucky. She was charged with actually not tippling, but a disorderly house. There were colored soldiers who kept coming to the house intoxicated, and she said she could not make them leave, but they said she was the one in control of the house, and therefore, even though there were five other families, five other rooms being rented, she was the one held accountable. And she protested this charge. She protested in a petition that she was a poor washerwoman, that she had three children, she was a single mother, and was not in control of the house. And in fact, not only was she not in control of the house, but increasingly many of these petitions recognized that these so-called masters were not in control of black people. They could not stop them from drinking. They could not stop them from gathering. They could not stop them from meeting. illegally. And that became clear to me too as I looked at these petitions. There was a great deal of frustration, I think, by many of the whites who wrote in asking to have their charges dropped, remitted. And mostly what they were thinking about were the fines. They had extensive and really stiff fines for that time period. Some were fines of $20 for selling, giving liquor to Negroes was at the time, sometimes $50 fines. And they could be compounded. So there are cases where, you know, one person would have 13 pounds of tippling, disorderly house, unlawful assembly. All of these things carry fines. And these fines were, as I said, very high fines. I wanted to kind of find out what that meant. You know, what was a $20 fine? But today, we were roughly about $500. The $50 fine is about a $1,200 fine. And so people who were being fined upwards of $1,000 were facing, you know, well over $20,000 worth of fines for trying to keep people from drinking in a state where, you know, bourbon is part of the culture and the economy. I always wondered how to, well, I was about to say something in the Senate chamber, I probably should not have said it. But I'll say it anyway, because it was that. How in the hell did they really think they were going to keep black people from drinking? There was liquor everywhere. It was kind of an interesting thing. You know, I wondered, did they believe in their power that much or not? And nevertheless, these cases generated so many fines. And that was the major thing that when whites wrote in that they complained about. They did complain about many other things. They complained that some of these cases were really about malice. They were personal, they were political. Keeping in mind this time period where there were unionists and secessionists and guerrillas, there were personal attacks through the courts. Others complained that the informers received one-fourth of the fine. And so they were concerned that the same person who testified against them, informed against them, would then go to court and receive part of the fine if they were found guilty. They raised these kinds of questions. Some even raised the question of principle. You know, they said that they were not knowledgeable about the law or they had tried to stay within the law, but had still ran afoul of it. But most of them complained about the fines. And they complained primarily that they were too poor to pay them. Part of this had to do with the Civil War. You know, they argued their labor was gone, their fences plowed up, the Union soldiers, the Confederate soldiers were constantly seizing their property, depressing their property, they were not repaid for these things. So there was a grave concern about the fines and how they could pay them, whether they were just. Many of them argued they were highly unjust. But for others, there was another concern with the fines, which is those who were unable to pay them, people like Ann Carson, faced being sent to the city workhouse. Others faced being sent to the Kentucky State Penitentiary, which at that time was a for-profit prison. Many people had some grave concerns about this. Of course, the state was incredibly poor, so they were attempting to generate revenue. And as I said, all of this was kind of mind-blowing as a 20th century historian, thinking about for-profit prisons and fines. And you know, it wasn't hard to think about Ferguson. It wasn't hard to think about mass incarceration. I was left with a lot of questions, though. You know, I was left with a lot of questions. And, you know, with my 1 minute, probably less, I'll raise some of them and put a period on my portion of the comments for now. In addition to the question of, you know, how they really thought they were going to keep black people from drinking, where bourbon was so important, corn liquor was so important. I also wondered about women in tippling. They do not appear in very many records. You would get the sense that women did not drink. Although if you were to think about the work, for instance, of people like Gretchen Long, Doctor in Freedom, she talks very clearly about many black women who were drinking in this time period and were consuming liquor. So I kind of wondered about other records, but not in these Tipling records. So I wondered if there was some connection between Tipling and manhood, or if I'm looking in the wrong place or asking the wrong question. So that was one thing that came to my mind. The other thing that came to my mind was that for many, it's clear that alcohol and liquor was about pleasure. It's about feeling fine and mellow. But I wondered if it was also about pain. I wondered if it was also about addiction. I wondered if it was about the kinds of things that Heather Williams describes in her wonderful book, Helping to Find My People, the grief, the sorrow, the loss that many black people endure, not only as slaves, but particularly in Kentucky, where so many families were being split by this domestic slave trade, where so many families were being split as their wives or children and fathers were being sent to Natchez in New Orleans to feed the cotton and sugar plantations of the Deep South. And so I wonder a lot about the danger and the risk that many people went to get alcohol, and I wondered if that was just pleasure or if that was part of a larger health crisis that many scholars have begun to think about in the time period of the Civil War. People like Gretchen Long, Jim Downs, think about the question of health and well-being and how we might think about alcohol as part of that question. And then, of course, I got to the end of this and I realized, you know, I started as a 20th century historian and I thought about those questions around Ferguson, of course, and fines and prisons and thinking about Kentucky's black population, in which, you know, 20% have been disfranchised through mass incarceration. But more recently, I also thought about, I think through this pain of pain and addiction, I've wondered a lot about Kentucky's opioid crisis today. Mm-hmm. And I've wondered about the ways in which people are facing criminalization behind what's really a health crisis. The ways in which people are being fined today, sent to prisons today, denied health care today, in the state that, you know, frankly, I love to call home. It raised a lot of questions about where we are today, you know, as we debate healthcare nationally. It made me really wonder about those things. So as I said, I had a lot of questions, and I know I've gone over a minute, but those are some of the questions I was left with. Hopefully, you'll have other questions, and we'll put our questions together and have a discussion. I'm looking very much forward.